loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, sitting in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is visiting Trump and Mar-a-Lago today. Both leaders are dealing with scandals, and Abe's approval ratings are in the 30s or even 20s, according to one opinion poll. How will the visit affect the Trans-Pacific Partnership, high-level diplomacy in Korea, and other key global issues? Next, debate is raging in the British Parliament over the highly unpopular decision by Theresa May's government to join the US-led missile attack on Syria last Friday. Opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn is pushing for a War Powers Act to limit the ability of a prime minister from launching military action in the future without consulting Parliament. Then, a series of deadly attacks across Afghanistan, the government says was carried out by the Taliban, took place over the weekend, leading to dozens of deaths as the spring fighting season gets underway. Will the U.S. occupation of the country ever end? And then, a federal court ruled recently against a 2017 Maryland law that let the Attorney General sue pharmaceutical corporations for price gouging. Is this another case of corporate profits coming before people's needs? And finally, David S. Bakel was a prominent LGBTQ rights lawyer who litigated landmark cases for marriage equality and the rights of LGBTQ youth. Later on, he fiercely advocated for protections for the environment. He died on Saturday after setting himself on fire in a tragic act of protest against climate change. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the summit between Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and President Trump at Mar-a-Lago. Both leaders are dealing with scandals, and Abe's approval ratings are in the 30s or even 20s, according to one poll. How will this visit affect the Trans-Pacific Partnership, high-level diplomacy in Korea, and other key global issues? We're joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. He's the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He's the author, most recently, of The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and Red Star Over the Third World. Welcome, Vijay.
Thanks a lot.
So one of the key issues that Trump and Abe are expected to talk about is the United States rejoining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is a blockbuster trade deal. Donald Trump made opposition to the TPP one of the main planks of his 2016 presidential campaign. But now, do you think that he might be considering rejoining the massive free trade pact?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that when Trump decided to break with the free trade pact, I don't think it should have been taken too seriously. At the time itself, the United States was doing two things. One, it was involved in bilateral trade agreements with a number of countries. That was the preferred mode in which the United States was trying to get a good deal for itself, or at least its corporations, in world trade. And the second was that it was trying to box in China. And the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was quite openly about China. In fact, President Obama openly said, you know, if we don't go into the TPP, then we're going to let China write the rules. In other words, the United States must write the rules, not China. So there were two reasons that the United States, or two ways in which the United States has been trying to push its agenda in world trade. The withdrawal from the TPP was only one leg being slightly tied, but the other leg was going strong, which is to use bilateral agreements to push for American trade domination, or at least to get the United States a good, you know, bargaining position. The re-entry of the United States into the TPP, I think, has a lot to do with a series of miscalculations by the Trump government regarding both the Koreas and Japan. And I think also this might be slightly a sop to Shinzo Abe, who put a lot of stake internally in Japan on the TPP. And I think he was surprised and humiliated when the United States decided to walk away from it.
Vijay Prashad is our guest. We're talking about Shinzo Abe's visit to Mar-a-Lago to visit Donald Trump. I'm looking back, Vijay, at the New York Times from about 3 weeks ago, and it's about what actually happened, the fact that Abe was and the Japanese leadership were blindsided by the fact that there had not been a waiver granted to Japan, while a waiver was granted to other, quote, U.S. allies for the steel tariffs. I want to read a couple sentences to you and then have you comment. For Japan, the hits just keep on coming. Only last week, Tokyo was scrambling to recover after being caught flat-footed by President Trump's abrupt acceptance of an invitation to meet Kim Jong-un personally to discuss North Korea's nuclear program. On Friday, officials in Japan awoke to the news that it was the largest American ally to be left off a list of countries temporarily exempted from the stiff tariffs on steel and aluminum imports by the Trump administration. Now, Vijay, Lawrence Kudlow, the new economic advisor to Trump, says in the discussions between Trump and Abe, the issue of the waiver or the immunity granted perhaps to Japan is, quote, on the table in today's discussions. Just talk about that, if you would. Why was Japan left out?
Well, I can't tell you why Japan was left out. But look, it's very fascinating. I mean, China is Japan's main export market, not the United States. And these tariffs on China were also going to indirectly hurt the Japanese, because the Japanese supply China in the global commodity chain. In other words, part of the products that the Chinese sell to the United States have within them Japanese goods. So I don't think there was very careful thinking in the White House when they went ahead with the tariff project against China, because after all, it's not only Japanese products that are within the end products from China, but also American products, because the American products are also in the global commodity chain and enter the final product that comes out of China. So that's there. I think Mr. Shinzo Abe needs to really consider what he's going to do when he's at Mar-a-Lago. After all, recently, you might remember, the Trump government decided to go against a 2012 trade agreement with South Korea. The Trump administration said that trade agreement was, you know, destroying the United States. And the government of Moon Jae-in said, well, okay, we'll renegotiate the South Korea-United States trade agreement, this bilateral agreement. And the South Koreans went back. They put some pressure on their own domestic auto manufacturers, said that they'd increase American cars. A new deal was struck. And as soon as, you know, Mr. Moon Jae-in was able to negotiate things with his own business lobbies, the Trump administration turned around and said, well, we're not going to sign it. The only way we'd sign this is if you agree with us on Pyongyang and on the nuclear question. Of course, Moon Jae-in has a very different attitude towards making peace with North Korea. In fact, now it is suggested that North and South Korea might actually sign some sort of peace agreement. And so, you know, here we have the situation where the South Korean government went back to their business lobbies, renegotiated things with them, came back with a deal quite favorable to the United States, and then the Trump administration said, no, we want a political discussion now, not merely economic. Similarly with Japan, you know, Shinzo Abe, you know, he expended a great deal of his own domestic political, capital. And by the way, he didn't have very much to begin with, going after the farm lobby, the business lobbies in Japan, all of these who were very unhappy with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, with the idea that they would have to so-called globalize their sectors. And once Mr. Abe was able to get them at the table, agreed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Mr. Trump decided to leave. So, I mean, I think the message to South Korea and to Japan should be that the United States is not a reliable bargaining partner. I would hope that somebody around Shinzo Abe whispers that into his ear.
You know, at the end of World War II, there was essentially an arrangement reached between the Japanese ruling class and the United States, whereby Japan would be allowed to compete economically. Japanese corporations could still go around the world, and especially around East Asia, making money, exploiting people. But the military aspect of Japanese power had to be essentially outsourced to the United States, which would set up, you know, a complex of bases across Japan. Many thousands of U.S. troops would be stationed there, and Japan would be placed under the, you know, the so-called U.S. nuclear umbrella. Shinzo Abe, and you know, this was formalized in the Japanese Constitution, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution that renounces war. Shinzo Abe doesn't want that. He wants to repeal that. He wants to remilitarize Japan and, you know, build up its forces to where it perhaps once was. We have about 1 minute left. Korea is sort of the excuse that Abe can use, you know, the supposed threat of the North Korean nuclear missile program. Do you think that he's going to be sort of whispering in Trump's ear, encouraging him to turn back the tide when it comes to détente on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, look, the first thing that Mr. Abe wants is to be part of the meeting with the North Korean leadership. You know, he's been cut out of this entirely, and the Japanese want a seat at the table. But I think Mr. Abe and the Japanese ruling class in general knows that their bargaining position is very weak. You might remember that in 2009, when Mr. Hatoyama was the prime minister, he came from the Democratic Party of Japan. When he tried to push for removal of a U.S. base at Okinawa, his government fell. It fell, of course, after Hillary Clinton made a surprise visit in Japan. That story, of course, has not yet been fully told. So I think the issue of North Korea provides the Japanese with a little bit of space for negotiation. But to be frank, they've been utterly left out of the discussion. And I don't think Trump is going to, you know, take Mr. Abe seriously when it comes to the conversation around the Korean Peninsula.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. He's the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research and chief editor of Leftward Books. He's the author of many books, including The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution and Red Star Over the Third World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Co-host John Kiriakou is out traveling this week. Debate is raging in the British Parliament over the highly unpopular decision by Theresa May's government to join the United States and France in the missile attack on Syria last Friday. Opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn is pushing for a War Powers Act to limit the ability of a prime minister from launching military action unilaterally in the future without consulting Parliament. We are joined from London by Robert Griffiths. He is the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Britain. Robert Griffiths, welcome back.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Just for those of us over here, especially in the United States, where, of course, Donald Trump acted without congressional approval, but actually Congress didn't want to be asked because they, if anything, thought Trump should go further with the war. Tell us what it's like right now inside the House of Commons, inside of UK, what Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party are asking for and what the response is from the Theresa May government.
Well, I'm afraid the war psychosis inside the House of Commons chamber doesn't seem to have any resonance amongst large numbers of people outside. They're whipping themselves up into a right old frenzy in the Commons. And there are a few things more nauseating than a pack of British MPs in a fit of moral self-righteousness and superiority. This latest escapade hasn't got everybody dancing in the streets over here. The memories of the Iraq War are still very much alive. There's been a sea change in the British mood about these things. I mean, in the end, probably with the media going, you know, full pelt, most of the media anyway, in support of this, this latest military adventure. In the end, they might just about scrape together a majority of public opinion that says, well, perhaps it was justified. Although I don't think they've actually achieved that yet. But there's a deep, deep skepticism here, and there has been since the Iraq War. People know that they were lied to. They know that they were misled. They don't trust politicians. They don't trust intelligence services when it comes to matters of war.
It's not unusual at the beginning of a military operation for there to be a frenzy or a war hysteria created. Of course, it would be even more so should British troops or American troops or the troops of any country be sent off into battle, into harm's way. In this case, the United States, Britain, and France can sort of stand off and use standoff weapons to just make sure all the bleeding is done on the other side. But even still, we have, as you've mentioned, as a consequence, perhaps even most importantly of the Iraq war, the debacle, the catastrophe, the awfulness of that war, American public opinion and British public opinion has been deeply impacted by that. But let's talk about what Jeremy Corbyn is actually asking. He's saying that there should be a War Powers Act, that the Prime Minister must consult with Commons, the Commons, with the House of Commons, and get approval before carrying out unilateral action. Is this basically about the future, or is there any sort of resolution condemning the action that took place last Friday?
Well, I doubt very much if the Labour opposition has had the opportunity to put down a motion condemning the attack. I think it was almost certainly the choice of the Labour leadership to go for something more positive that would quite possibly unite the largest number of MPs from his own party and from some of the other opposition parties behind it. I think if there had just been an outright condemnation of the government action, unfortunately, there would be plenty of Labour MPs who wouldn't be prepared to do that. They're happy to bomb almost anywhere on the planet if some kind of justification can be scraped together. Whereas to defend the sovereignty of Parliament and the right of MPs, which MPs have enjoyed for several years now, the supposed right of MPs to exercise a veto over military engagement, I think there are still plenty of MPs who think that that is an important principle. So I suspect Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour leadership were looking to maximise the support for whatever resolution they'd be permitted to put down in Parliament. The War Powers Act that Jeremy Corbyn is proposing, of course, would require by law a Prime Minister to go to the Commons for permission before engaging in military action. Now, this has been attacked on the grounds that, are you saying that under every conceivable condition, a government must always go to Parliament for such permission? Well, of course, that's not what Jeremy Corbyn is proposing. He fully recognises that there could be extraordinary circumstances when no government would have the time and possibly the opportunity to go to Parliament for permission before retaliating, say, to a surprise attack of a huge magnitude. But I don't think that, even though the motion is designed to maximise support, it's very unlikely to be passed. Most of the Tory MPs, not all, but most of the Tory MPs are uniting behind the Prime Minister. As I say, almost any foreign bombing or invasion by British troops will get the support of a fairly significant minority of Labour MPs. So there's no chance of this War Powers Act becoming law, unfortunately.
And of course, if we think about it, when the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, a surprise attack, it was very quick and easy for the president. And at that time, public opinion had been divided about entrance into the war. But unanimously, the U.S. Congress passed and declared war against Japan. Because, of course, under those circumstances, a country's government would do and be able to do just that. So this argument by the Tories that this denies the British government or any government of the right to do extraordinary things under extraordinary circumstances is nonsense. But it does. I want to talk about, Robert, if we could, Jeremy Corbyn, if we think back to the past few years, conventional wisdom did not expect Corbyn to win the leadership of the Labour Party. Conventional wisdom did not expect Corbyn to prevail over the Blairite wing of the Labour Party. He endured and withstood and was victorious against numerous assaults against his leadership. Theresa May called the quick election thinking this would be the ultimate decimation of the Labour Party. Just the opposite happened. Jeremy Corbyn did very, very well. At each turn, in the face of what seemed to be, according to conventional wisdom, all of these headwinds, Jeremy Corbyn and the left wing of the Labour Party prevailed and got stronger. When you're looking at public opinion in the UK right now, of course, this was a quick attack. It was over. There wasn't a lot of, you know, requirements for the British population or the British military to keep going and possibly endure suffering on its side. But can Jeremy Corbyn also, or is this another circumstance where, confronted with headwinds, Corbyn ultimately prevails?
Well, I don't know if I would go quite that far, because certainly there have been occasions in the recent past where Jeremy Corbyn has opposed British military action, but there's been majority support for that action within the great British public. But I think the intention on the part of the Tory government and some of his own backbenchers, the intention to use this attack to in some way further try and discredit Corbyn, I don't think that has yet been successful. And I suspect it won't be. As I say, there's no great enthusiasm for this attack. A lot of people are a bit bewildered. A lot more people are saying, well, you know, why the rush? Why launch this attack hours before the OPCW investigation team was arriving at Damascus Airport? In fact, now we'll be asking why this attack to destroy three sites that we're told were crucial to Syria's supposed chemical weapons program. Why have those sites been deliberately destroyed before the OPCW can inspect them? All these kind of questions are being asked. And whilst I wouldn't say there's huge enthusiasm for anything that smacks of pacifism, if you like, you know, most people in Britain are not pacifists and they're not about to become pacifists. So all the attempts to brand Jeremy Corbyn as a sort of pacifist in principle, you know, they could do him a little damage. At the same time, he hasn't really been damaged by this. And I think the majority of people are saying, well, why the rush? Why couldn't we have waited so that Parliament could have a say? Why couldn't we have waited so that the OPCW team could have done its work and provided its report? So, no, this hasn't. I don't think this has damaged Corbyn to anything like the extent that powerful forces in Britain were hoping. And as again, we shouldn't forget, whilst Parliament might be spending an enormous time on this and the media are obsessing about it, for a lot of people in Britain, this is not a huge issue. They're more worried about housing, about jobs, about services, about crime and so on. These are the concerns of most people. And on quite a few of those issues, Jeremy Corbyn is saying the kind of things that people want to hear.
Yeah, we're out of time. Sadly, I would like to continue to discuss this. We've been joined from London by Robert Griffiths. Robert is the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Britain. He was also one of the leaders of Lexit, which was the left-wing organizations that supported Britain leaving the EU. We're out of time. We'll be back and continue to discuss this story. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A series of deadly attacks across Afghanistan, the government says was carried out by the Taliban, took place over the weekend, leading to dozens of deaths as the spring fighting season gets underway. Will the U.S. occupation of the country ever end? We're joined from Iowa by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
So the war is clearly not winding down. If anything, it's only intensifying. You've been to Afghanistan many times. You know, you've been a leader in the movement against the U.S. occupation there. Tell us your assessment of where things stand right now, and what do these attacks that we saw over the weekend tell us?
Well, I'm kind of curious because I've not heard the words about the spring fighting season in a while, because it really hasn't. It's been, the seasonal ebb and flow is not been apparent because the fighting has gone, you know, all through the winter. And this is, as President Trump said last year, that the gloves are off and we are you know, the fighting's intensified, and this is a natural response. You know, there has not been an attack on a school, I don't think, in 10 years. And this is, you know, every expert, you know, people in the government, people in the military all say that this, that the occupation and the fighting by the attacks by the U.S. government and the Afghan proxies are only fueling the insurgency. They're not making it abate at all. So yeah, this is unfortunately the natural and unavoidable outcome of the continuing occupation.
When Donald Trump talks about, you know, the gloves are off in Afghanistan, you know, what he's really primarily referring to is an uptick, a dramatic uptick in U.S. airstrikes that are being conducted across the country. Those airstrikes, though, they don't just kill, you know, Taliban fighters or ISIS fighters. You know, the U.S. is actually killing large numbers of civilians with these stepped up aerial bombardment campaign. Is that right?
Oh, yes, you know, definitely. And we have the hangover from the Obama administration, which famously said that that a non-combatant in these terms are now anyone over 14 years old who happens to be in the area unless they're posthumously proven not to be combatants. And so the whole concept of battlefield with these airstrikes and the drone surveillance and drone assassinations, the idea of that there isn't any line anymore between what is a battlefield and what isn't, and who is a combatant and who is a target and who isn't. It's leading to it is chaos, and it's, you know, being reflected in these increased attacks by the Taliban and other insurgents there.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Brian Terrell. He's a longtime peace activist, the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Brian, we've seen the war in Afghanistan escalate steadily over the past several years. I mean, this is going to continue, isn't it? Brian Becker, go ahead.
Okay, sure. Yeah, we have Brian's issue. Let's just go for our audience understand what these were. There are four attacks across Afghanistan Saturday and Sunday. 26 government security officers killed. The school, two schools set ablaze. One of them was a girls' school. And as Brian mentioned, attacks on schools have been rare. Maybe the burning of the girls' school was a sign from the Taliban that, of course, the Taliban does not believe girls have the right to go to school. There's something else about the attack, Brian, that I want to mention to you. I'm looking at the New York Times. This was sophisticated. There were long-range snipers involved. There was also the use of equipment, including sophisticated night vision technology by the insurgents. In this case, let's assume the Taliban. They were able to function in the dark because of these night vision goggles. But the Afghan military and the Afghan pro-government militias and Afghan police also want these night goggle visions capability, this technology. But the U.S. government says no, it won't allow them to have a technology that the insurgents have because they say they fear it will fall, this technology will fall into the hands of the insurgents, into the hands of the Taliban. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's very curious, isn't it? Because there hasn't been that same reticence to the technology of you know, Stinger missiles and automatic weapons that are, you know, freely distributed. You know, that are falling into the hands of the Taliban, but they don't want the Afghan government to have, you know, something as non-lethal as
night goggles,
night vision technology. That's absolutely absurd. Also, I think these attacks have been on the Afghan local police, which I think needs to be clarified because these are not really local, and they're not really police. These are militias that were established by the United States. They're under the control of the U.S. military. They're not answerable to the police or the civil government of Afghanistan at all. They're answerable to the United States. And these are groups of men who are trained, who have only 3 months training, and are given, if they're not given night goggles, they are given automatic weapons. And operate kind of parallel and sometimes contrary to the in conflict with the actual Afghan police. So it's the chaos that's being sown through these policies is, you know, just can't be measured.
Yeah, I want to stick with this issue, Walter. I mean, this is a big deal. The Taliban have gone high tech. That's a headline from the New York Times from 10 days ago before these attacks. That poses a dilemma for the U.S. That's the second part of the headline. I want to read a couple sentences. Once described as an ill-equipped band of insurgents, the Taliban are increasingly attacking security forces across Afghanistan using night vision goggles and lasers that the U.S. military officials said were either stolen from Afghan and international troops or bought on the black market, which they could have also been bought from Afghan soldiers. The devices allow the Taliban to maneuver on forces under the cover of darkness as they track the whirling blades of coalition helicopters, the infrared lasers on American rifles, or even the bedtime movements of local police officers. With this new battlefield visibility, the Taliban more than doubled nighttime attacks from 2014 to 2017, according to the Pentagon. And yet, the U.S. can't trust the Afghan military forces fighting on the side of the NATO coalition with comparable nighttime technology because they don't know where it's going to end up. I mean, it's what Brian Terrell said, of all the things that they've allowed to introduce into the battlefield, like, you know, shoulder-held missile launchers and all the rest, they really don't. Brian Terrell, they really don't trust the Afghan fighting forces on their side. And I think, if I remember right, the U.S. might have suffered more casualties to American or NATO troops from the Afghan police or military than from the Taliban, at least in the recent period.
Well, I'm not sure what the statistics are, but there have been, they call it the blue on green, because of the blue uniforms that the Afghan forces have. Yeah, and these Afghan local police I was talking about are often involved in these attacks on U.S. forces. You just cannot, in a volatile situation like Afghanistan, you're not going to be able to put in massive numbers of weapons and have any control over where they go and who uses them. It's totally irresponsible, and the results are so predictable that they are, you know, inevitable.
Yeah, and this is a common problem for the United States when they, attack a country, occupy it for many, many years. You know, we can look back at the invasion and occupation of Iraq, for instance. You know, when ISIS launched their surprise offensive in the summer of 2014 across Iraq, it turned out that 50,000 members of the Iraqi military were quote unquote ghost soldiers, meaning that they existed on paper so that their commanders could collect the salaries that they would be paid. But they did not actually, you know, they were not reporting for duty. They were not actually members of the armed services. It seems like, you know, impossible perhaps for the United States to set up a reliable proxy force in a lot of these countries where they come in and impose themselves as occupiers.
Right, and those forces are not going to they're not going to demand the loyalty of their members, the people who are being trained and armed in these militias and even armies. Their loyalty to a government that's a puppet propped up by somebody else, you know, who they would see as robbing them and their families, it's not going to be inspiring them to feel like they've got a lot at stake in supporting the armies and militias that they belong to themselves. So yes, they will be wanting to sell weapons and give information and go over to the other side. If it's not, that's not anything to wonder why.
We're gonna have to leave it there. But Walter, Brian's right. And when you think about the political calculus here, the U.S. government really fears any American casualties in Afghanistan. So if they don't give night goggle technologies to the Afghan soldiers, because they might in turn give them to the Taliban or use them against American soldiers, if some of them get killed as a consequence, it's not a political liability for politicians here, where an American death is potentially, or multiple American deaths are potentially a political liability. So at the core of this sort of weird, bizarre, ridiculous military policy is a political calculation too. Anyway, we are out of time. We've been joined from Iowa by Brian Terrell. Brian is a longtime peace activist and a co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A federal court ruled recently against a 2017 Maryland law that lets the attorney general sue pharmaceutical companies for price gouging. Is this another case of corporate profits trumping people's needs? We are joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a producer for Loud and Clear. Welcome, Nicole.
Thanks so much.
So tell us about the basics of this appeals court ruling.
So this was the Fourth Circuit. They have a number of different judges on the circuit, both from Republican administrations and Democratic administrations. The two, so the way that these circuits work, there are three judges who are selected for these cases. Two of them ruled, one was an Obama appointee, one was a Bush appointee. Two of them ruled that this was a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. And one of them dissented, saying that it was not. This was how this was decided.
The law that was passed by the Maryland state legislature and then signed into law by the governor. What does that stipulate exactly?
So the law just allows the state of Maryland, the attorney general, to be able to sue pharmaceutical companies if they've had a really massive price increase in their drugs. The law allows for a $10,000 violation or a $10,000 fine for any violation, which in pharmaceutical company world is nearly nothing, with companies that are making billions and billions of dollars every year. And they have an actual line that they're using. If you have if you see a 50% or more increase in the price of this drug, which I think we can all agree is a pretty big increase for something that already exists. And these are also pharmaceutical companies that are manufacturing generic drugs. So these are, you know, formulations that have been on the market for a long time. Then that's when the AG is allowed to sue these companies. And so the court said, you know, we're not going to let you be able to do this. This was the Fourth Circuit, so this can go higher and it can be appealed. But I thought the dissent was actually really, really strong. So the dissent by Justice Wynn makes it very, very clear that this actually should not apply and that Maryland should be able to do what they want to protect Maryland citizens. This is allowing Maryland residents to be able to have access to really basic drugs that they need to get around to exist to deal with any health problems. And they, you know, the dissent cites really important precedent to kind of show that that's it is definitely not how it should have gone.
Nicole, appellate judge Stephanie Thacker, who is an Obama appointee, appointed by the Democratic president, Barack Obama, she wrote, after she said that the law passed by the Maryland General Assembly, the elected officials of the people of Maryland, she wrote, "To be clear, we in no way mean to suggest that Maryland and other states cannot enact legislation meant to secure lower prescription drug prices for their citizens. Although we sympathize with the consumers affected by the prescription drug manufacturer's conduct, that would be price gouging." She didn't write that. That's me. "And with Maryland's efforts to curtail prescription drug price gouging, we are constrained to apply the dormant commerce clause." So we have elected officials democratically deciding that pharmaceutical companies should not be price gouging on medicine that people need to stay alive. And yet it doesn't override the dormant commerce clause. What is that?
The Dormant Commerce Clause, and I'm also quoting from the opinion, is driven by concern about economic protectionism and seeks to prevent state regulatory measures designed to benefit in-state economic interests by burdening out-of-state competitors. So essentially, it's saying that one state can't regulate something that's going on in another state, which totally makes sense. But in this case, the way the Maryland law is written is it's only talking about interactions and sales that happen in Maryland. So the only thing it's regulating and the only thing it intends to regulate is things that are sold in Maryland. So Thacker is making an argument that this will affect things out of state But the dissenting opinion is very, very strong. And I think accurately argues that the way that the state intended to have this written and the way that the state will actually enforce this is only about things happening in Maryland to prevent price gouging from happening to Maryland consumers.
Where will Maryland go? Where will the attorney general go? I mean, obviously, the Supreme Court could hear the case. Do you know, Nicole, whether there's divided opinions? Have other circuit courts ruled otherwise on issues like this regarding the Commerce Clause, in which case it might be taken to the Supreme Court?
I'm glad you asked. Yes, in the dissenting opinion, he writes that the conclusion conflicts with the approach taken by several sister circuits courts. So, you know, this is also really out of step with other circuit courts and what other circuit courts are doing.
It would seem to me, Walter, that that's what's going to happen. That's what needs to happen. Although when you look at the Supreme Court, there's no guarantee, given the fact that it seems to be completely in the pocket of corporate interest, that they would do something different, but they could do something different.
Yeah, the other recourse that the state of Maryland seems to have is petitioning for an en banc hearing of the case, basically to retry the case, but instead of in front of these three judges that, you know, serve on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, they would basically argue the case to all judges that sit on that Court of Appeals.
Which you think would make a lot of sense because I believe there's 10 people who have been appointed by Democratic presidents, but we're talking about Thatcher, who was appointed by Obama. So there's really no guarantee that consumers will actually get the right end of the stick here. And I want to be really clear that in the dissent, Justice Wynn writes that neither the Supreme Court nor this court has ever relied on this doctrine as the sole basis to invalidate a state statute. So this would be really, really big, a really big ruling that kind of changes things if this is actually held up, and most likely that should not happen. I also want to talk a little bit about why this happened in the first place, why this law actually came in.
Yeah, let's get to the heart of what's going on.
So there were two reports that were put out, one by the government accounting office and one by the Senate, talking about the massive increases in generic drugs that have happened in pricing. And two of them actually were formed and managed by investor Martin Shkreli, otherwise known as PharmaBro. And these price increases are not like by a little bit, a cent here, a dollar there, you know, or a couple of percentage points. These are drugs that have been increasing by 300%, by 1,000% in pricing. And these are the kinds of things that Maryland is trying to protect. I mean, overall, generic drugs have been staying about the same in price or going down. But the problem is these, you know, specific drugs that might be, maybe there's not very many of them needed. Maybe only a couple of people need them a year. Maybe they're, you know, expensive to produce. But, you know, the profit from these other drugs should be able to even out. And there's no need for these price increases to be happening, which is why Maryland's trying to protect its residents.
So, Nicole, I mean, this is really a form of extortion, right, by the big pharmaceutical companies. You know, you have, I mean, even less than 50%, you know, 50% is what this Maryland law says. Okay, well, that's the red line where you can't, you know, increase it beyond that. But even let's say, you know, if they decide to stay within the bounds of this law and raise drug prices by 30%, I mean, that actually means that people will die, right? I mean, there are certain people who just simply will not be able to afford medications that are that expensive. And so these giant pharmaceutical companies that have all this political power are essentially using their position in the economy as, you know, the private providers of life-saving medication and leveraging that and saying, well, look, you've got to pay up.
Absolutely. And I think when you read the opinion, too, it absolutely reads that way. It reads specifically about making sure that commerce, you know, between states and commerce that, you know, pharmaceutical companies that deal in multiple states won't lose profit. That's what this is about. What this is about is making sure that these companies can maintain their profit, they can increase their profit, and that CEOs can go home with millions of dollars each year.
I mean, compared with all the other high income countries, the United States spends more per capita on prescription drugs than all of them. I mean, we're talking about Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom. They're all high-income countries. They're advanced industrial countries. They're all capitalist countries, meaning they have the, quote, free market principle, which, of course, is not the free market. But again, why are the American people saddled with a system? And why do the judges, against the will of the elected officials even, maintain a system whereby what's obviously just ripping people off? I mean, why are we here, Nicole?
I mean, Maryland is not the most progressive state ever, right? I mean, that legislature is mostly Democratic, but has an entire rainbow of Democrats and people who prevent all sorts of really progressive, important reform, like reform to their incarceration systems, et cetera. And yet they were still able to pass something that could have actually made a difference in people's lives. But to your point, Brian, there are judges coming in and reading this essentially the way that they want to read this. Both opinions are strong. I mean, we can see in many cases that there are judges who make decisions based on political things as opposed to being based on law, because law is inherently political.
And, you know, the other thing that really gets me about this is that you have liberal and progressive people telling everybody, vote Democratic, even if you don't like the policies, because at least the Democrats will appoint the judges. They'll appoint the Supreme Court judges. They'll appoint the appeals court judges. And then we won't have conservative judges who will simply act sort of as a vehicle for big business or with reactionary positions. But again, Stephanie Thacker, who wrote the majority opinion in this disgraceful decision in Maryland, is an Obama appointee.
Yep. She was just appointed as an Obama appointee in the last Democratic administration.
Walter, we're out of time, but this issue, I think, will keep coming up. It's going to go perhaps to the Supreme Court. Certainly, it has to be the premise, the basis for large campaigns at the grassroots to make drugs affordable.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She's a producer for Loud and Clear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
Now we're going to talk about a widely reported story, the tragic death by suicide of David Buckle. David Buckle was a prominent LGBTQ rights lawyer who litigated landmark cases for marriage equality and the rights of LGBTQ youth. Later in his career, he fiercely advocated for the protections for the environment. He died on Saturday after setting himself on fire in a dramatic act of protest against climate change. It took place in Prospect Park in Brooklyn. He wrote in a letter found by his body, "Pollution ravages our planet, oozing uninhabitability via air, soil, water, and weather." Clearly, David Buckle was a truly troubled individual. But the issues that he dealt with could not be more important and could not be more urgent. Climate change is becoming the dominant, or perhaps one of the most dominant, issues in world politics. Where are we and what are we doing to stop it? That's the question. We are joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. Professor Magdoff, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
David Buckle, while known earlier for his work on LGBTQ rights issues, also had turned his attention and focus to work on the environment, the dangers, the obvious dangers posed by pollution, but also by the very dynamically changing environment and climate. When you read this story, what came to mind?
Well, you know, I feel very sorry that a person did something like that to himself, that he felt so strongly that he had no other outlets but to do this, to make a statement. So I'm not encouraging this. And I feel sorry for him. Obviously, he was just wrought by what's happening. But he's absolutely right as far as what he wrote in that email that was sent to the Times, to the New York Times. He's everything he says is right. What you just read. I don't think you went on to read the whole thing, but in my mind, it's a very accurate statement of what's happening.
Yeah, let's focus a little bit on the letter, Walter.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't hyperbole, right? When we're talking about, the planet becoming uninhabitable. Walk us through a little bit. What are the mechanisms, like what are the particular pieces of climate change that will perhaps lead to the planet becoming unfit for the maintenance of human civilization? I mean, there's rising sea levels, there's, the temperature, of course, but it goes far beyond the temperature. It's about that cascading effect of that, correct?
Yes, but, he talked about, and rightfully so, if we're talking about the environment, he talked about other issues as well. And I think that we shouldn't forget them. You know, the pollution of the air and the soil and the water and the pollution of us by all sorts of exotic chemicals. It's, you know, the loss of, I don't think he mentions the loss of so many species by extinctions. So that there are many other issues that are happening, and he points to many of them. He says, like, most humans on the planet now breathe air made unhealthy by fossil fuels. And it's true. You know, you know, the pollution in the air is causing, on a global basis, a tremendous amount of deaths on an annual basis. And even those who don't die from it, you know, are made sick because of it. So it's fine for us to focus on climate today, but we shouldn't forget these other issues, which are part of the devastation that's being caused on the planet, to the environment of the planet, the ecosystem as a whole. How the ecosphere functions, and so those are all important issues. On the other hand, climate change may be the most dramatic for the long term, and it's already has you know, observable results. But let's not forget the other ones.
And the planet is an extremely unequal place socially. I mean, we have a system that creates, you know, a handful of people who control, you know, more wealth than the poorest, you know, 4 billion people on the planet, the poorest half of humanity. Talk a bit about how these environmental disasters that we're talking about, both those related to the change in climate and those that are related to other harmful health effects related to the burning of fossil fuels and other, you know, unsafe practices that are so core to the economic system of capitalism. How does that impact the different classes on this planet differently?
Well, basically, if you're poor, you're more likely to live in neighborhoods where there's more pollution. This may be air pollution. It may be water pollution. Waste is frequently disposed of in dumps in poor areas. The Indian reservations in the United States, where there was a lot of, in some of the reservations, there was a lot of uranium mining. Those are plagued by the dust that's left over from the spoils, you know, from left over from the rocks that were mined, and it's polluting people all the time out there. So, but in general, the poorer you are, the chances are you're going to be exposed to more pollutants of all sorts. And it doesn't mean that wealthy people aren't exposed to pollutants. They are, but just not the same extent as those that occur within the poorer communities. So that's sort of a general phenomenon if you look worldwide. So getting to we can get to climate if you want to, because I think that's the most important issue. I just don't want us to neglect these other issues, that's all.
We're talking with Professor Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont. He's the co-author of the books What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking about the dire crisis facing humanity when it comes to climate change and other pollutants. Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, Walter, we started this story because of the tragic suicide of David Buckle, whose suicide note outlines, as Professor Magdoff said, the terrible state that the world is in and the failure of the existing powers that be to do anything about it, which doesn't mean that nothing can be done about it. It just means the powers that be and those who have a vested interest in maintaining the current status quo don't want us to do anything about it because they're not thinking about the future. They're thinking only about the future of the next quarter's profit margin or what they can show investors. Let's just change up, though, a little bit. We didn't talk about climate per se, Professor Magdoff, but, I mean, this may be, I don't know, empirical in a way. Well, it totally is empirical, but, you know, I'm looking at what happened yesterday. Snow records toppled in Wisconsin, South Dakota, Minnesota. Records fell as an April snowstorm blanketed the upper Midwest. The National Weather Service says that the 14.9 inches at Minneapolis Airport from Friday through Sunday set a new record for the largest April snowstorm ever. In South Dakota, Sioux Falls set records for a single day in April at 13 inches on Saturday. In Wisconsin, the storm ranks as the second all-time largest snowstorm in Green Bay at 23.5 inches and a record April total of more than 35 inches there. And at the same time, there were tornadoes all over the place. these extreme weather events, I know everybody says, well, you don't know, this is just one event, one knockoff, but this is pretty remarkable. We're in the middle of April right now.
Well, snowfall in April isn't that unusual. It's the quantity that's happening. And also, this is the beginning of the tornado season in the south, mainly in the south, although, I mean, it happens in the midsection and in some parts of the north central. But so I think it's the quantity, and that's one of the things that happens with climate change. The storms have more water in them. There's more evaporation from the oceans. The rainfall is more intense. You can have higher snowfalls. So that's one of the aspects of climate change. Another one is that patterns, weather patterns in the Northern Hemisphere tend to remain for longer periods than they did previously. So that if it's like we had, I've forgotten how many, three or four different storms that swept across from the central part of the United States to the east and created Northeasters, as they call them, storms along the coast of New York and New England, one right after another within just a few weeks' time. And this is just extremely unusual. And it's an example of what happens with the weather pattern just not changing. You know, it kept going. So, and this is believed to be, I mean, this has been predicted because of the warming of the Arctic is much more rapid than the warming of the mid latitudes. So that the difference between the two, the Arctic and the mid, is decreasing. Excuse me, is increasing, the difference between the two. So this is something which is causing the jet stream to behave in such a way that it goes into a certain pattern and holds that pattern for its particular period of time. So it's that decrease. I think I misstated it, but it's that decrease in the difference between the temperature in the Arctic and the temperature in the mid latitudes that's responsible. So that's one issue with regard to these storms. And the other one, as I mentioned, that storms like Harvey and these storms and the snowstorms or rainstorms hold more water. They've got more water in them. You get more intense downfall, more total water, etc. These are aspects of climate change. There are others also.
We've been joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. We're completely out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us at Loud Clear Radio on Twitter. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.